Now, in depth with Francis Rose.
Welcome to the Federal News Countdown for Friday, May 8th, 2015 on Federal News Radio. The three most important federal news stories of the week as selected this week by two experts in the world of the federal government. And my experts on the countdown this week are Dan Chenick, the executive director of the IBM Center for the Business of Government and chair of the Industry Advisory Council. It's good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you, Francis.
Thanks for coming in, as always. And you have quite a responsibility on the program this week, I hope you know.
And what is that?
You are breaking in a rookie on
Indeed.
The Federal News Countdown.
Indeed.
Your colleague on the countdown has never been on the program before. It's Dave McClure, the chief strategist of the Verisk Group, and many-time guest, but first-time on the countdown. It's good to see you, my friend.
Always a pleasure.
Pull that microphone up nice and close to you, and what we'll do is we will, as we always do, count down the three most important federal news stories of the week, as each of you gentlemen have selected them, and we start where we always do with... And we'll start with the rookie first. Dave, your choice at number three is from FCW. The headline is, "It's about the customers, not the stakeholders." And it is a former colleague of yours, Greg Godbout, at formerly at the General Services Administration. He's just transitioned to EPA as the Chief Technology Officer. But I wasn't surprised, I guess, when I saw you put in a story about customer service as your choices for the countdown this week, Dave.
Absolutely. Well, in that and the reference to the fact that the government should operate like Disney World, I mean, that also caught my attention. But yeah, Greg's a good colleague of mine. We work together in standing up 18F. I think the message of this story is so core to improving government. It's about really getting our focus around the customer and the customer experience. Those are terms that get overused. But in the IT field in the government, we get so caught up in designing, writing, and putting in place systems. And oftentimes, we are very poor at understanding what the recipient of the service truly needs to experience from a customer perspective. So I think it's just really foundational to improving government performance.
Is it fair, too, to add in the concept that when you think about a system, you think about a system performing a certain task or service, and maybe we're a little conditioned for silos and not thinking about how that system fits into the enterprise or the way that the customer sees the entire operation that they're dealing with?
Yeah, and oftentimes they don't want to see the operation. Mm-hmm. I think that's our challenge, is they don't care how things get done. If I want to get online to pay taxes, or I want to see the water quality around my house, or the quality of schools, or traffic congestion, I really don't care how it's done. I just want to be able to get online or on my mobile phone, and I want that interaction quick, seamless, friendly, and highly usable. And those are just characteristics we've got to build into the front end of IT.
There's one example that we've heard from any number of different people, from Vivek through just about everybody, is people expect an experience like they get on, name the consumer website here. And you made the reference to Disney World earlier, but it's legit in this case because Greg apparently was just at Disney World. Mm-hmm. And they have what they didn't have, I guess, the last time I was there. This story says a magic band wearable allows guests to do everything from purchase items to open hotel doors with a wave of the hand. Now, you understand that Disney is really at the cutting edge of technology and customer service and the intersection of those things. But I really appreciated what Greg said in the story, which was we've kind of acted in government for a long time like that's for everybody else and not for us, and that it's okay for us to be a little – he didn't say the word clunky, but that's my word.
Yeah.
It's okay for us to be a little bit clunkier because we're government, and that doesn't really cut it anymore.
Yeah, and I think that's the challenge inside of government is getting the workforce, whether it's programmatic officials or IT specialists, to think differently. It's not about designing something good enough. It's not about designing things as we've designed them in the past. It's about being innovative, creative, and doing the experience the way you would want to do it rather than just the way it's good enough for somebody to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think our challenge in the government with this kind of approach deals a lot with identity management and authentication. You know, for us to seamlessly shop a citizen around to different services really requires us to put something like connect.gov and other things in place so that experience, again, is as quick as it can be.
Dave McClure's choice is the third most important federal news story of the week from FCW. The headline, "It's about the customers, not the stakeholders." And that story and all of our countdown stories linked up later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Dan Chenick, your choice at number three this week's from NextGov. The headline is government's mobile sites and apps rated more highly than many companies. And I bet if you asked 100 people on the street what they thought the result of this survey would be, I bet government would lose 90% of those people.
So this shows that there are good things that happen across government. And I think that it shows, you know, customer service and the digital service transformation that we're seeing has already started to spread toward a lot of really productive changes in how agencies are using the web to deliver services and to present activity. And Dave talked about the customer service. I think there's a lot of progress that's been made in agencies across, like at the Veterans Department of Veterans Affairs with their chief customer service officer. You mentioned the Industry Advisory Council that I'm the chair of. They have a whole customer service initiative that's trying to help agencies work this through technology. And this website survey that was that the article referred to really kind of looked behind a lot of the data that the government now has on USA.gov to say, what are people's opinions and expectations in terms of government sites versus industry? And one of the things they found was that actually, government sites got higher ratings than sites in the financial services industry. So I think, you know, we talk a lot about problems. This is one of those stories where the government seems to be making good progress.
And then the next step from that seems to be, so what are the agencies doing? What is government doing better than the private sector companies? And how do we do more of that? I don't think we spend as much time as we should maybe in this sector thinking about that concept of examining the things that we're doing well and how we do more of that.
Yeah, I think that the combination of sort of digital service, a lot of the work that Dave led, the agency teams that are working these who came out of really the new media movement that was brought into the government in a large way when the Obama administration came in and has continued to sort of permeate the government, has now started to percolate through the government in terms of how do we use the web as a channel to deliver content more effectively. Certainly not all government websites are there. There's still a lot that are, to borrow your words, probably still a bit clunky. But there's a lot more of this, and citizens are seeing this, and that's what the results of the data are. So it's really trying to, again, take a customer-centric view of how you present the data. And because you do have now more and more people in government who have that mindset, they're starting with the web because that's what they know, and they'll move through other facets of customer service over time.
Well, and I've told this story probably a million times before, and you may have heard me tell it, but I recall a conversation I had with one of the an early social media adopter in government, and this person was very excited because their agency was going to have a Facebook page. And I said, "So what are you going to do with that? How are you going to communicate with people?" Well, we're going to be on Facebook, and we're going to be able to interact with people. And it was a destination rather than a vehicle. And so what it sounds like you're saying is that, the numbers here seem to indicate, is that agencies are comfortable now delivering digital services as a vehicle and not as a destination.
Well, I would say they're getting more comfortable, and there are more examples of that which are being used. And a lot of the survey results show that the people who are coming into contact with government, because the sites that are good sites tend to get more traffic, you know, good sites beget good traffic, so to speak. The sites that are still on the improving path aren't getting as good traffic. So the survey data in this survey probably went more toward the high users, which are going to gravitate more toward those sites that are attracting more users because of their quality.
The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Dan Chenick from NextGov. Government's mobile sites and apps rated more highly than many companies, and you can find that and all of our choices on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Dan Chenick and Dave McClure on this week's Federal News Countdown. Be right back. This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Dan Chenick and Dave McClure, and we are up to
number two.
And Dave McClure, your choice at number two this week is from FCW, the uncertain marriage of CDM and FedRAMP. Now, this is somewhat equivalent in my book, you choosing a FedRAMP story, to when Stan Soloway is on and chooses stories in which he's quoted in every single story. But, you know, I didn't tell you that you couldn't pick stories about your gig.
I didn't know the ground rules.
No, well, and there's no ground rule. You're allowed to. But what's the connection that you saw here? And do you agree with the concept of this story that the connection between CDM and FedRAMP is still evolving, maybe?
Oh, it's definitely evolving. But the reason why I chose the story is I do think that FedRAMP and CDM are connected. The thing I wanted to dispel was any belief that FedRAMP was developed without CDM in mind. Hmm. In fact, one correction to the story is that FedRAMP actually predated the launch of the CDM initiative with DHS and GSA. We had continuous monitoring requirements built into the pilot phase of FedRAMP. We knew DHS would be charged with the responsibility of coming up with ultimately what those continuous monitoring measures would be, but we couldn't hold up. So I think Matt Goodrich and company over at GSA have done a great job in ensuring that FedRAMP acknowledges this continuous trend toward moving away from static compliance security checking to dynamic near real-time operational security. So FedRAMP has that built in. It will have to evolve it. There's no question, because that's the fastest growing space in cyber today.
I have only one question about Matt Goodrich. I think he's terrific and he's done a wonderful job, but is it possible that he may just be a little too into his job? His Twitter handle is Mr. FedRAMP.
He's great.
Isn't that terrific?
He's great.
That would be like if I became Mr. Fed News Radio or
you
something
could.
Like that. I could. It's probably available. this connection, you and I have been talking about that transition that Dave just mentioned from checking off boxes to actually proactively being aware of what's going on with your network for a long time, Dave.
Yeah, so it's an interesting balance. In a FedRAMP, is primarily still for the cloud. The official policy is it's for cloud-based applications. CDM looks at all traffic coming in over the internet. So there's a little bit of a different shape of the box that we're talking about, but they're very compatible. FedRAMP does adopt NIST controls, some of which are not CDM-based, some of which are more based on good process, sort of the classical NIST controls. And so some people say that there's a little bit of a dichotomy, because to do a FedRAMP, you have to go through all the NIST stuff that has not yet been really truly CDM focused. But NIST is also evolving toward more of a continuous diagnostics and mitigation type approach in their work. And the issue is, you don't want to be entirely tactical. You know, you want to have good process, you want to have good training, and you want to make sure that agencies are doing that. But you also want to have the real-time monitoring that comes through CDM. And as these two things converge, and as they expand beyond the cloud, it'll be how do they bring those together in a way that's practical for agencies.
How do you see that shaping up, Dave?
I think it'll work out fine. Again, GSA, the FedRAMP PMO, works very closely with the NIST folks on the new risk management framework, the new CDM guidelines, and with DHS. So I guess what I would want to do is reassure everyone, there are no silos here. This has been actually orchestrated so that the parties are working together. I don't think there will be agreement on, you know, what gets dropped, what gets added. I can tell you from putting the FedRAMP program in place, we spent 2 years getting consensus and agreement on what the initial set of controls would be. The other, I think, big piece of this story is that the private sector vendors, the cloud service providers, ultimately all providers to the government, are very concerned about what they're actually reporting to the government. It is extremely sensitive information. It can be proprietary in some cases, because it deals with their specific technology arrangements. So there's a lot of hesitation on the industry to actually want to do this full force until they understand what it is that they need to report, what's the dashboard that would be used, who would see it, and who has access to that information. Because, again, it's very, very sensitive stuff.
If I may stick my nose into your business as the IAC chairman, Dan, I think that idea that Dave just conveyed of all those organizations working together with no silos would make a terrific case study, because there's a whole lot of places in government that could use some best practices based on what they did to be able to connect across cultures and connect across languages and terminology and be able to communicate with each other as successfully as they have.
Sure, I would agree with that. And I think you'd add in OMB and the Office of the Cyber Coordinator in the White House, who has sort of a staffer that works on federal issues as the leader. So IAC's done some work around integrating security protocols like this into acquisitions to make sure that as companies are bidding jobs which have a cyber component, that the acquisitions are clear about what expectations are laid on companies in terms of the services that they provide. And I think that the new one of the new elements that we're still implementing is in December, of course, we had a new reauthorization of the security statute that authorizes all of the Federal Information Security Activities, FISMA. And now, and that reauthorization addressed a number of elements to bring in CDM-type concepts into FISMA. They weren't there before. And now you've got legislation for both the government and the private sector that's being discussed in Congress to emphasize information sharing and monitoring about threats and real-time information sharing and to create incentives for companies and governments to share that information for one another. So I think you're seeing this expanding shared situational awareness picture moving out from government and into a group of stakeholders that are necessary to combat the threat.
Dave McClure's second most important federal news story of the week is from FCW. The headline is The Uncertain Marriage of CDM and FedRAMP, and you can find that at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Dan Chenick, your choice at number two, is also from FCW, Rewiring the Pentagon, Carter's New Cyber Strategy. The new cyber strategy is out now from the Department of Defense. And Dr. Carter introduced this when he was out in Silicon Valley, and there are kind of two schools of thought about this. One school of thought is that the significance of that trip was the release of the new cyber document, and there's another school of thought that the significance of that trip was the Secretary of Defense was in Silicon Valley trying to directly engage thought leaders out there. Do you fit into one of those, or could you see both of them being the important thing or the pair of important things coming out of that trip?
Yeah, well, I picked the story and the set of events that are going on here for both reasons. Because of the increased importance of combating the cyber threat, not just as a matter of government effectiveness, economic effectiveness, but also military effectiveness. And threats really know no boundaries. So a threat to a system can come in through any one of those vectors, civilian, economic, government, or military, and then spread to the others. And so the DoD cyber strategy really is sort of the Defense Department's view from a military perspective. How do we build a workforce, build a set of activities where DoD can share information, respond effectively? But it's not just a government issue. It involves interacting strongly with the technology sector, with the critical infrastructure sectors like energy and utilities and dams and transportation. And so for the defense secretary to go out to the technology community in California and other places around the country and say that the defense of the country from a cyber perspective matters as much by what you do as by what we do, and I'm here to get the best ideas to be able to share that, I thought was a very powerful message in terms of the interplay, both from a inter-sector collaboration perspective as well as from an actual performance perspective. We're going to get better performance by interacting more effectively.
It's a unique situation because it's the only one of the five domains in the Defense Department, Dave, where that interaction with the private sector and the knowledge that the private sector accumulates is really as critical or more critical than the information and knowledge and so on that the department accumulates itself.
I think that's the big shift. And significance of the article is the recognition, as Dan said, that within DoD, which is a powerful entity comprised of an enormous research and tactical capability, there is this willingness now to recognize that the innovation and technology and some of the most innovative cyber technologies are being done outside of a DoD environment. So I think that's a huge step forward for DoD to be able to actually accept and reach out and try to bring that community in a much more aggressive fashion into the DoD realm.
There's a deeper message here, too, I think, that we haven't touched on yet, and I'm not sure I saw any of the news coverage of Dr. Carter's trip touch on. One of the themes of Better Buying Power has been, how do we bring in companies that have information, knowledge, abilities that are not currently part of the defense industrial base? Mm-hmm. And the message that I took away from this is, they're serious about trying to do that, and they're going to be aggressive about that outreach. Yeah. And there's two parts to that. Then there's, to all of you companies that have not been part of the traditional defense industrial base, we want to know what you're doing. But there's a message to the companies that are part of the traditional defense industrial base, and that is, you can't sit on your laurels anymore and just assume, because you do business with us, that you're always going to get the same chunk of business that you're getting now.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. There's reference in the article to using NQTEL as a venture capitalist function with a much more aggressive agenda than before. I think that's absolutely right. It's a wake-up call for the large DoD defense companies that this secretary is quite excited about looking outside of the traditional streams of business for ideas and for innovation.
2 points on this. One, I think that the aperture shouldn't necessarily only be regionally based. There's a lot of innovation around the country that mm-hmm. is not happening in Silicon Valley.
Right.
And it's happening in other parts of the country. So to the extent that Secretary Carter and other technology leaders in the administration go out, it's really important to take a broad aperture of innovation coming from Boston and Austin and other parts of the country that mm-hmm. that are where there's a lot of innovation happening. The second thing involves the Defense Department, excuse me, looking to bring in innovation in sort of a new flow of innovation from the companies, in terms of allowing an opportunity for not just new companies, but the existing companies that are a part of the existing industrial base to compete on a level playing field. And I think a lot of this is sort of the current system, and both companies and buyers are embedded in what the current system is. And there's a perception that the current providers aren't as innovative because they've been here for a long time. A lot of it is because they haven't been asked in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if the government starts asking for innovation from the current providers in the same way, they're going to get a better result. And they're going to actually get lots more synergistic improvement, because they're going to get great ideas from new companies, great ideas from companies that are already there, because they're asking both sets of companies to come up with new and innovative thinking.
So your comment about not ignoring the other places around the country where innovation is happening is right on point. And that's the reason that I was more drawn to the imaging and the message sent by this trip to this location mm-hmm. than I was by the actual fact that he was in that location. Mm-hmm. The message that it sends to the average American, or to the people who care about this stuff, whether it's government people, think tank community, all of that, that's what struck me more. And it seems logical that his next trip would probably be to Austin, or to any of these other places where there's a lot of technology innovation going on across the country. But I think you're right on target. And I have a hard time imagining that won't happen. Or maybe if it's not him, it might be Frank Kendall, or it might be some of the branch ATLs, ALTs, whatever, also going out to see what the options are, what the possibilities are.
Yeah, and there's a lot of interest in the small venture capital arena, as well as small firms that would love to get into the DoD and non-DoD side of government. The entry points have been tough to overcome. I think this is an aggressive reaching out from one of the biggest, if not the biggest, IT player and cyber player in the government to say, we're open to new ideas, we're open to new relationships. And that's refreshing. Again, I think if I were in a small business or venture capital role, I would find that extremely interesting and very, very excited to respond to.
Dan Chenick's choice as the second most important federal news story of the week is from FCW, Rewiring the Pentagon, Carter's New Cyber Strategy. And you can read that and all of our countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Dan Chenick and Dave McClure. The Federal News Countdown continues in a moment on Federal News Radio. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by Dan Chenick and Dave McClure. And we are up to Where are we? Oh, the singers are a little bit slow this week. The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Dave McClure, is from FCW. The headline is CIO Tony Scott says Fed tech is a contact sport. I appreciated that Tony was willing to lay it out in that manner, Dave, but I don't know that anybody that follows this stuff is really surprised to hear him say it. It's just the fact that he said it that way, I suppose.
Yeah, well, you know, I think this is a fabulous title, and it has to go to really the reason why I picked it is it's really about Vitara, and it's about Vitara's extension of Klinger Coing, something that that I worked on. Dan and I worked on other things, but I'm pretty familiar with creating contact sport things in the federal government. I think the good news is that Tony's absolutely right. You know, we can create authority, responsibility for CIOs all day long in the federal government if they don't, if they're either not allowed or don't know how to participate in the larger governance, budget, decisional processes of an organization. They will never, ever have any impact. And the organization will probably not get good use of IT. So that's, I think, the huge difference from Vitara. It is adding in a lot of things that we just simply didn't put those kinds of details into Klinger Cohen. But we certainly learned in the last 20-plus years that that governance piece, that authority piece, that process piece needs to be wedded into it for CIOs to be successful.
The line in this article that stood out to me, Dan, is almost at the very end. The guidance, and you can read about that, the guidance at federalnewsradio.com, the guidance isn't meant to corral agencies into standardizing their business processes. Here's a guy who's been, Tony's been in government for not long, how long? And yet he understands already what the first objection or the first, maybe second or third objection right behind the first one's going to be from the agencies about, don't tell us how we have to do everything. We're different and unique and we're special snowflakes and we need to be able to figure out on a, and I mean that in a lighthearted way. I don't mean to criticize, but he anticipated very astutely what one of the concerns was going to be.
Yeah, well, Tony brings a great career in terms of working in large enterprises where you also have different power centers and different sort of CXO influences on the process where he's worked through, and whether it's Disney or VMware or General Motors and or Microsoft, his other experiences that he's had. And so he brings an understanding of large corporate enterprises and that there are different power centers and you have to work through as a driving force for technology. Because technology will make everything else better. But by doing so, bringing along the allies that you need, the folks who hire people to do the technology, so the HR teams, the folks who pay, so the CFO teams, and the folks who deliver in a company that would be the basically the offices that do the selling and delivery, and government would be the program side. And so bringing those together, and the Vitara guidance really does a nice job in laying out this sort of shared governance framework where technology is the core, and CIOs under Vitara have to be driving that, but there are a set of players that are involved in a governance process.
One of the things that I think makes that makes so much sense, Dave, is understanding that agencies are also at different places on that continuum. Yep. There are some agencies where CIOs are already pretty heavily involved in the decision-making process. There are others that haven't gotten quite to that point yet or anywhere near that point yet. And so it seems to me it's an understanding and a tolerance for that. It sounds more, this guidance read to me more like, show us what you got. Mm-hmm. This is the way you should go. Now show us how you're going to go in that direction.
Yeah, I think so. And again, it brings transparency and evaluation to what is actually being proposed, which is a good thing. I think you're right. There are many agencies that have technology embedded in their business, and this is a little bit lighter lift.
Mm-hmm.
There are other agencies where technology information is a side activity. And those are ones where I think it's going to be more problematic. You know, for years when I was in the administration, the number one issue that was raised in the government that CIOs were challenged with was governance. This illustrates that governance is core to making a CIO successful. They have to be part of that governance process. So what I would be doing if I were in government is I would be training or doing something to raise the awareness and knowledge levels of how to run good governance processes, because at the end of the day, you can put a CIO at the table, you can empower him with budget authority, But the process that makes the decisions about what to do is broken.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to have to be a focus for the next few years.
Dan?
So I think Dave's absolutely right. And while we're talking about FITARA, we shouldn't lose the sight of the process that OMB is going through to actually have developed the guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike many OMB guidance documents, this was developed with input from a wide variety of stakeholders before it was drafted, and then it was put out for comment. Having spent many years at OMB, it's not something that I practice very often around OMB guidance.
Shame on you.
Absolutely.
These folks are moving way beyond where I ever was, and it's to their credit. I think there'll be a much better process and result in the end.
Will we be able to tell that when the final product comes out? How will we be able to go back and will we be able to read through it and see, oh, okay, so it was shaped in this way by the public comment process or by input from whatever?
Well,
is that knowable?
Think about a rule that goes through a public comment process.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have the before and after that you'll be able to see. I don't know the extent to which OMB will have sort of a preamble where they'll lay out, here are the comments we got and here's the responses. But it'll be very transparent because you'll see the before and after. And then the explanatory material will probably just provide some level of context.
Be interesting to see what we can learn from that.
I think the big challenge is, a year from when the guidance is finalized, what's the measure of success? The measure of success may be that there are processes in place, there's authorities clearly defined, and all of that. That only gets you halfway down the road. At the end of a year or more, we've got to start seeing better IT solutions in place. We've got to see more ROI for what we're investing in the government's technology. And that, again, is a tough issue.
And I might argue that maybe the next important milepost after that is 2 to 3 years down the road when you've had a change of administration and the shine has kind of worn off of FITARA and it's not top of mind anymore.
Right.
What sticks?
Yep.
Because, you guys had the best of intentions with Klinger-Cohen, but the fact that we're sitting here, 20 years later and talking about how it stuck or didn't stick, it indicates to me maybe we could see the same thing with FITARA, despite the best of intentions and the best outcomes foreseen.
Mm-hmm.
Do we get 2 or 3 years down the road and people say, well, nobody's really paying attention, so we'll just kind of go back to the old ways?
Good management statutes provide a framework. The framework gets filled out by the strong ideas and initiatives, often that are accompanied, you said, 2 or 3 years from now when a new administration comes in. Hopefully that new administration will come in with a set of ideas and initiatives that excite government, excite the technology community, and excite the program community to use technology in a new way. I think some of that you saw, for example, in the Quicksilver process, where I was still at OMB and working in that, and some of that you saw in the current administration when Vivek Kundra came in as the federal CIO and drove forward a process. So I think there's an opportunity in the new administration for new leaders to come in and take the foundation that Tony Scott and the OMB team are laying here and then really drive that forward.
I guess the key there, too, will be to see what the political transition is and to see who the players are that are involved with that and see whether there's an inclination to say, well, especially if it's a Republican president, to say, well, this was somebody else's stuff and we don't agree with the ideological point of it, so we're just going to ignore it. And that would be really unfortunate and not very smart, I don't think.
Yeah, but I think, again, this is a nonpartisan issue. It doesn't matter whether you're coming in on
the
side. Yeah, well, it is, because if you come in and you're focused on reducing the size of government or increasing the cost effectiveness of government, which tends to be a larger bell ring by the Republican candidates, this is absolutely a way to make that happen. This puts teeth in OMB that was not there before. It puts teeth in CIOs that's never been there before. On the other hand, if I'm interested in innovation and forwarding technology's impact on mission, this is the right thing to do. So I think it's a nonpartisan play.
Fingers crossed. Dave McClure's choice is the most important federal news story of the week is from FCW. CIO Tony Scott says Fed Tech is a contact sport. You can read that story and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week is selected by Dan Chenick. We'll wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week. as selected by experts in the federal government, Dave McClure and Dan Chenick. And Dan, your choice at number one this week is my colleague Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com, OMB requiring 5% cut in discretionary budget for 2017. A number of elements here that jumped out at me when Jason first reported this story. What did you see that you thought made this so significant this week?
Well, first of all, being from OMB for many years, whenever the spring guidance comes out, that's always my top story. It's interesting because it shows continued focus on discretionary spending control. So agencies have to come in at a 5% reduction level, but also shows a data-driven decision-making process that's being demanded of agencies to identify where the investments can come in to improve management and effectiveness. So you've heard the Deputy Director for Management, Beth Kober, talked about the elements of the management agenda. And this budget, I think, more than any of its predecessors even, it sort of builds on its predecessors, really drives home this use of evidence, use of administrative data, use of data sources to help agencies make decisions about what works so that as they're looking to get more effective and efficient with their use of resources, they can really identify those areas where they know what works and put their money in those areas and move it away from other areas.
Jason cites this quote from the memo. To further these efforts, agencies are invited to submit, which I guess translated in OMB talk is required to submit, Dan. Is that fair to say?
Strongly encouraged.
Strongly encouraged. All right. Proposals that scale up interventions or policies that have been tested and shown to work. And two, proposals that are that will further develop agencies' capacity to use evidence, evaluation, and data as tools to improve program outcomes. So it's that invited to submit phrase there, Dave, that I thought was particularly significant. I mean, okay, strongly encouraged. This is really what they expect to see from agencies.
Absolutely. And I agree with Dan. You know, this is definitely a step forward. I think it's a huge endorsement of fact-based or evidence-based decision-making about what you're going to invest in and coming up with more than just, you know, pie-in-the-sky numbers and just throw it out because it's a budget exercise and no one really checks.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's getting real. It requires much more analysis, and it requires bold initiatives on the part of the agencies to actually demonstrate how they can achieve both cost reductions and areas where they think they should be investing more and making a case for that. That's the other side of this that I think is very, very good.
The data gives you the ability, too, to recognize places, things that you can get rid of.
Yep.
And you know, you can take the GAO duplication, overlap, et cetera, and when you've got data to attach to each of those, you can go, well, maybe we should give up this area of autonomy and give it to some other agency because they're doing this well according to their data or some other part of our agency or whatever. And we can take that because we're really killing it in this one particular area, doing really well, and that's where more money should go.
Yep. It allows OMB to make those trade-offs. Mm-hmm. It allows agencies to make those trade-offs when they're presenting the budget to OMB. It allows OMB to make decisions about those trade-offs. Part of the guidance was around government-wide shared services in administrative functions and moving that forward and getting more data to make better decisions in that area. The other thing that's really important, I think, from this guidance document is this paragraph after a new stat session.
Mm-hmm.
So OMB is introducing something called FedStat, which is essentially an evolution of what in the technology world, Vivek Kundra started with TechStat and Steve Van Roekel then built on with PortfolioStat, which were both sort of technology-focused. TechStat in the case of individual systems, PortfolioStat looking across the entire set of activities. FedStat, which will really be led by Beth Cobert and her team, will look across at all the different management areas and use data to demonstrate how are these programs performing and where can they make improvements. And mm-hmm. I think that's a real interesting analog to the budget development decision-making that will go on with the evidence. They'll be using budget execution decision-making or decision-making about how programs are actually performing as well.
So another line in the story that rang my bell was right at the very beginning, the second sentence. Unlike in 2016 when OMB required both suggestions for a 2% discretionary cut and a 5% increase across specific programs, the administration just wants agencies to reduce spending for 2017. Now, Jason's reporting that factually. Do you think the message that one naturally derives from that is correct, though? Dave, I'll start with you on that one.
Yeah, I think, you know, I saw that sentence as well. And again, there are other parts of the story that kind of clarify that a little bit. I think there is a focus on cost reduction. But as I said, I think as a result of this discussion around transparency and data, agencies can make a strong case for investments, for shared service solutions that they want to either drive or be part of. You know, one of the most powerful things that came out of the initiative Dan was involved in, the Quicksilver Initiative, was actually not just looking at how much money was spent on different kinds of financial centers, but to get more granular and ask what's the cost per transaction. It was so revealing when you saw those numbers, you know, from $1.29 per transaction to $15, and you go, why are we spending that kind of range? Why? What makes these so different when they're basically all doing financial transactions for the federal government?
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of transparency this, I think, is designed to focus on.
Dan?
The guidance also, we'd be remiss in not pointing out, that it talks about the Data Act, and today is basically, well, tomorrow technically is the one-year anniversary, but today is the last workday of the first year. And so OMB today released a guidance document and a set of standards. And the Data Act will actually show and allow for financial transparency in a way that will bring the types of decision-making that Dave described, and in the future allow agencies to make better decisions and allow the public to have better transparency into how those programs are performing. So all of this kind of fits together in the context of using data, making it more transparent, forcing agencies to make better decisions, and OMB is moving the ball forward in that.
We just have about a minute left. Anything else about this guidance that we should be thinking about as the agencies start to get to work on fiscal 2017?
Well, I do think it does accelerate or continue this push for shared services in the federal government. I'm a big believer in shared services. I think we have some initiative and momentum underway once again for that. And so I'm pleased that that will be part of this effort as well.
Final thoughts,
The other
Dan?
Thing is that it does talk about digital services teams. Mm-hmm. In the 16 budget, there was an investment of, I think, $105 million for those teams and agencies. And this repeats some of that. And now the challenge will be, once those people are in place, how do you implement that? How do you scale it? How do you make it more of a regular part of what government does, as opposed to a few projects? So how do you build on the success of the digital services teams and expand it in the future?
Dan Chanik's choice is the most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com, OMB requiring 5% cut in discretionary budget for 2017. Gentlemen, a terrific federal news countdown. Thank you, both of you. Dan, another terrific performance as always. Not bad for the first time
pretty
the
good,
rookie was on the
good.
Show here,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Very, very great.
I didn't
very
throw
nice
any
to see
flags
you.
On Dan either.
No, you didn't. You were very understanding. You can find the federal news countdown archived at federalnewsradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas.